Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Today, we're exploring the profound nature of trauma, how it affects the body and makes it keep score. In this episode, we delve into trauma is not just the event, but it's the impact that it's had on our bodies, on our minds that keep it happening long after the event has passed. How our bodies and minds are still responding long after the danger has passed, creating what my guest, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, talks about as something that feels unbelievable, unbearable, and overwhelming. You'll learn why the prevention of movement during traumatic events is what makes it traumatic, and how childhood trauma creates an internal map and that guides our adult perceptions. And finally, how our healing must address even the basic housekeeping functions of the body. Dr. van der Kolk shares insights on reclaiming agency, the critical role of embodiment in healing, and why curiosity and collaboration are essential for creating a life worth living. Let's dive in. The way that you described trauma really struck me, and it's still something that I come back to today. And there's a number of things that you say, but there are three words that you use at one point that have stayed with me. And those are, you describe trauma as something that is unbelievable, unbearable, and overwhelming. Tell us more about what those three words mean to you in relationship to a moment in time.
You know, if you work in emergency rooms, which most people who do therapies these days don't have that background, most academic psychologists don't have the background. Then you get to see how completely discombobulated and out of it people are after an acute trauma, after you've lost your family in a car accident, after you've lost your family in a fire, after you have been shot. Nobody is rational. And anybody who deals with traumatism knows how deeply inarticulate and freaked out you become when you go back there again. Naive therapists still say to people, tell me your trauma story. Yeah, but you cannot tell your trauma story because it is overwhelming. And that's sort of trauma 101. No, you cannot tell your trauma story. You can tell a cover story, but you might be able to create more or less what happened. But you never quite, words can never tell the whole tale.
There becomes this element of dissociation where, because of the unbearable sensations that it creates inside, then it's hard to put together even a linear process of what happened. There's one patient in the emergency room that I saw when I was on vascular surgery rotation in residency. And this is one that I would love for your explanation of why she was this way and why she said what she did to me. I was called down to the emergency room and asked to evaluate this 22-year-old female. And as I walk into her cubicle, she had a knife stuck all the way through her right forearm. And she was completely calm. And as I sat next to her, I remember struggling to know how to ask her questions and what to do, given her apparent state of mind. And it was almost as if she didn't know that there was a knife in her arm. And as I gingerly started trying to gather a story, a history, anything that I could then work off of to know what to do, she said that she didn't know what had happened, that she was walking from the living room to the kitchen. And by the time she got into the kitchen, there was a knife in her arm. As the story further developed, her boyfriend had been there and he had been cleaning some knives. And that came to her later on. But why would she, in that moment, have no idea what happened and that truly be her reality?
Yeah. And that is, of course, something that has been observed since time immemorial, of people who lose access to experience, part of themselves, awareness. You can cut it off. And these are the sort of things that you run into, is this amazing capacity to dissociate if you deal with trauma, you deal with dissociation and people knowing and not knowing and feeling and not feeling.
I remember being kind of befuddled with how to deal with the amputation syndrome, where a person's limb had been amputated, whether for diabetes or another reason, and yet they still feel it. And I think that comes back to really just how resilient we are as a human being and what all our body and mind do for us in order to help us function.
But these are innate survival mechanisms that we carry inside of ourselves. And then the question for us is, how do we wake them up and how do we manipulate them, work with them and produce? And we are not very good at that anymore these days. You know what I mean?
One of the advances that has been so helpful, and especially with your work, is really understanding what happens inside of us when we experience something where we feel powerless, where we feel helpless. And then that leads to this inner rage and collapse. And one of the things that you are very clear on, which I love, is this idea that preventing people from moving when something terrible happens is what makes trauma a trauma. Can you speak more to why?
Yeah, because observation. Darwin started with this already in 1872, and then Renan noticed it, and Freud noticed it, and Pavlov noticed in a major way, and that his dogs got traumatized by a flood, standing in a laboratory. And then Pavlov says, I think they got traumatized because they were supposed to activate their fight-flight response, and they couldn't, and because the brain got rewired. And then today, we know a little bit about the brain. We don't know a lot about the brain. That's so we should not overestimate what we know. But the work of people like Joanna Duas really shows that indeed, if you cannot take an action in response to a threat, then something gets rewired inside of your brain and the experience, instead of being used to move and to fight and do something, which is really our natural instinct to do. If my computer suddenly falls off the chair, I'm going to move to catch it. And if I can't move to catch it, there's an experience at home. But as long as you can do something, that's what you're supposed to do. But the work shows that if at that point you're actively kept from being able to put something, there's a rewiring of that input that goes to the helplessness center of your brain that makes you go like, oh my God. Action is a critical component to maintain a sense of mastery, even in the face of threat. I think that's a notion that doesn't get paid enough attention to, in my mind. And the notion, the way I like to illustrate it, is basic training in the military. People who sign up to join the military tend to not be the most cream of the crop of the high school pass. People go join the military because they're poverty stricken, violent homes, have many other opportunities. There's not the people you would select of, you're going to be the next CEO of my company. But then they join the military, and what do? They put them through a challenging physical exercise that are quite threatening, quite upsetting, and then also humiliating at the same time, which I don't think is really necessary, but to really be posed to something that's really challenging, and then to realize, I can do this. Built up a tremendous amount of resilience, competence, and a sense of trust in yourself. And so there's a dimension in therapy that I find sorely lacking. And the programs that we actively support, and my foundation, our research foundation, and personally, programs involve a lot of movement, and like theater groups and martial arts groups and tango dancing. So people are very, really challenging. How do we get in sync with other people? Making music together. This year's conference could have a lot about how playing music together can really sort of calm people down and get in sync.
You know, that agency is, I think, part of the beautiful thing that happens with healing. And as you say that, I'm reminded of the study also done on dogs that really illustrated the learned helplessness that can develop and how deep that can go. And they took dogs, they put them on one side of a container where it had some electrical shocks embedded in the ground, and they tied some dogs to a leash to the wall. They shot the group of dogs. Some of them jumped over, the ones that could jumped over a small wall. And the ones that couldn't, their action, their movement was blocked. Over time, what happened is that even if they were now unleashed and the dogs around them were jumping over the wall, they laid down and just whimpered. They believed that they were not capable.
Learning how if an animal is exposed to something and cannot do something, that helplessness becomes a conditioned response. And that is true for many traumatized people we know. They sort of give up on themselves and don't have the feeling, I can do something that will make a difference. And if that switch occurs inside of you, it's going to be very hard to get there. Because healing at the end doesn't come from me and it doesn't come from you. We can sort of help people. We can push people. We can encourage people. We can love people, but they have to do it. We cannot run each other's lives. So if you have given up on yourself or feeling that you can do it yourself, there's a long way to go to restore the sense of agency. It should be an essential part of every treatment program. People should clean your room, you should eat, you should cook, you should do your laundry, you should do something to just take care of this creature who you are. That's sort of the elementary thing about taking care of them. And for many traumatized people, even that becomes hard.
I think this is why it's so important to meet them where they're at. And even if it's something really small, be able to have them start doing something where at the end of that, they can feel a sense of accomplishment. I did that one thing, and then build on that. From your understanding of the brain and the body in trauma, is there a deeper sense of learned helplessness that happens if the trauma happened at a different stage of life?
I think the field isn't quite as aware of that as it should be. Is that I encourage everybody to hang out with newborn babies and then hang out with very small children and to see how. What do these kids do? They're not talking, they're not reading, they're not interacting with people. What are they doing? They're exploring the effect that their bodies have on the world around them, vice versa. The old kids are very active. And what they're doing, they create a map of the world inside of their brain. We all carry a map of the world inside of our brain that's based on our actual experiences. Because that makes the brain into a predictive organ. And so then when somebody walks in the room or looks a certain way, your brain goes, oh, that's the sort of person who can help me. Or, oh, that's the sort of person who will humiliate. Or that's the sort of person who will be affectionate with me. That becomes your map of the world. And then you have to try it out. Is this indeed true? But it gives you a sense of prediction. And so if you have a history of having been abused and neglected, you get a map of the world of people will do terrible things to you. And there's no way in which you're going to grow up to be a trusting, agentic human being after you have been abused and neglected, because there's an internal map of the world. People are not going to like me. People will smile at me and then put me down. And when the lights are out, people molest me. And that really becomes your internal scheme of the world, which is not a rational scheme. It's not like, oh, Amy, you shouldn't think that that's really stupid and that's your past, because that's not how the brain works. So you cannot talk people out of these core attitudes. In CBT, they call it pathological beliefs, but it's not really a conscious belief. It is your map of the world. And so the big challenge is, how do you create a new map of the world? And we actually have learned something about it in the last 40 years.
One of the things that you describe is how much energy tremendous amount of energy it takes to keep functioning when these are the memories that our body holds, when this is the map that we're navigating every relationship and every experience in our life. And
it's not even memory. It's really the way that you are organized. Huh? That's how well you focus, how well you're able to filter out irrelevant information. I think it's a very important point. It's that, you know, when you're traumatized, you have to work very hard to just often have to do very simple things.
And the triggers then are so easy to pop up because it's almost like they're walking around on a tightrope where any little thing can happen and they feel like they're losing control again.
And you don't know what the trigger may be. Sometimes it's flagrant. A certain person comes in and reminds you of somebody that's done bad things to you. But usually it's not that obvious. It may be a little sound of the air conditioner. It may be the light coming in the window in a certain way. You know, it may be a temperature that changes. And you don't go, oh, the temperature changed. That reminds me of my bedroom when I was 3 years old. No, that is your automatic reactions, imprints, perceptions that you've organized how you see the world.
So does this surprise you then when we look at the common health symptoms and really, Bessel, the syndromes that are continuing to increase in numbers that seem to be related to a dysregulated nervous system that's just trying to survive threats that are everywhere in life?
It's a huge, and you know, because this whole PTSD thing comes out of the mouth of psychologists, sorry, people who think about the mind and volition and thinking, this whole issue of the body has been paid much attention to, because it's mostly psychologists who practice this field. The body and the bodily mechanisms underlying are still very much overlooked, and they're a big frontier, because at this point, we don't know all that much about how to repair those underlying biological systems may feed into developing autoimmune disease, that may feed into maybe even something like cancer. We don't know. We have to be careful being simplistic about it. But one thing that's been intrigued me, having been a psychedelic researcher for the past 10 years or so, is how many anecdotes we have of people on psychedelic therapy seem to have rearrangement of their relationship to their body. I don't think any of us has gone deeply enough into that, but we see stuff there that is really intriguing.
I love that you use that word rearrangement of our relationship with our body. Tell me more.
Yeah, you know, you're stuck in certain way. Like, let me give you my own personal example. I was born in 1943. There was a famine in Nazi-occupied Netherlands. A lot of kids of my birth cohort died, became very ill. I was a very ill little child myself for quite a long time, first 8 years of my life at least. And then what helped me, of all the things I've done, I got Rolfed. Rolfing is this very deep massage where somebody is saying, move your fascia away from your muscle. It's a very hard body treatment. You know, no psychiatrist in his right mind tells his patient, you should go get Rolfed. But, you know, when you start exploring, I think for me, Rolfing was probably the most helpful treatment I ever had, because I was living in the body of this starved, sickly child, even though I grew up to be quite a robust person. Core, I was still sort of organized like this. And after I got well, I lived in a body that was much more open and capable of taking on new configurations.
You know, one of the things that you bring up in your work, in your book, is how you say how many psychological problems involve difficulties with sleep, appetite, digestion, touch, arousal. And so any effective treatment for trauma has to address these basic housekeeping functions of the body. And when I read that. It allowed me, gave me permission to actually prioritize those things in my life, which as a surgery resident at the time, you can imagine how they had not been prioritized. But it allowed me to see that, wait a second, I can't just go to therapy and expect, you know, my issues to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. I've actually got to learn to live with and work with and be in connection with my body and its functions. And yeah. I started to see those things, like my sleep, as just as important as the therapy sessions that I was going to. I mean, I know that this has been your experience too, but whether it's been in medicine and working with my colleagues or patients coming in, the theme overall has just been how disembodied we are. And we don't even realize it. You talk about the healing journey and the purpose of healing, if we want to use that word, as really creating the life that's worth living.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Life worth living is just like getting up in the morning and looking outside and it's overcast and snowy and rainy. And say, oh, it is an overcast day. Maybe I should put on a raincoat when I walk the dog. Or maybe it's a good day to play the piano for a few minutes. Like, people tend to talk about trauma as the terrible thing that happened to you. But that is really not what the trauma is, because that terrible thing is in fact over. Done. You survived it. But your brain doesn't know it. And what trauma really does, it hijacks you away from feeling fully alive in the present. And so I hear quite a bit in supervision consultations I do. People say, let's talk more about your trauma. And my answer is, no, let's talk less about your trauma. Let's feel a little bit more about the raindrops that keep falling off the leaves outside your garden. Let's talk more about what it feels like to walk through the mud while you walk your dog. Let's talk, maybe when you play this tone on the piano, you should play it like this or you should play it like this. You know, it's about sensory awareness and the sensory engagement in your life. The other dimension that people almost never mention in trauma is pleasure. And how trauma really robs you of a sense of pleasure. And for us, time to explore is what does make you feel alive. Maybe to amplify those things that make you feel alive.
Do you see people living with trauma being blocked in their sense of worthiness and deserving to have pleasure and to amplify those things that bring them simple joys in their life?
So particularly, so most trauma that we see is the legacy of early abuse and neglect and the pervasive feeling that I'm damaged goods, I'm no good, I'm an unlovable person, goes very deep. So many people we know. And cultivating this capacity to feel pleasure in yourself is enormously important. And that usually involves movement and interactions with people. Now, of course, then we have our computer games that we can play, where we have a pretend sense of competency, a pretend sense of mastery. I mean, if you get a dopamine charge, but it doesn't do a thing.
This is very true. And it makes me want to ask your opinion on, given everything that you now know about the mind and body and trauma, what would be the core knowledge, and not just knowledge, Bessel, but the skills that you think are your universal ones that everyone should know in order to best navigate life and its challenges?
Well, I think it's important to realize that basically all good things in life come out of collaboration. And that the notion that it's all up to you, you cannot play volleyball by yourself, you cannot write scientific paper by yourself, you cannot set up a lab by yourself, you cannot do a podcast by yourself, you know, it's all about interactions. And then the sooner you learn about the diversity among human beings, how some people think the world differently than you do, and how other people have different concepts of the world. The sooner you learn about how we have different ways of processing information, that's very important. And so learning to be curious, and you're curious about not knowing what you don't know, and that's okay not to know things, but even better is try to figure things out. And so curiosity is very important. But when you're traumatized, you can't be curious, because...
Well, it's dangerous to not know.
Exactly. Right? So if you're traumatized, the world's doing terrible things to you, so you want to ward it off. If you feel secure, you're going like, will I read this book that's banned in school? Do I find it disgusting? No. Maybe I do. I agree with you. I find it disgusting also. But it doesn't mean that you are not allowed to read it. Instead, I find it unpleasant. And so this issue of tolerance becomes very important, which has to do with tolerance about yourself. And the more you understand your own dark parts and your own conflicts, the more, of course, you become tolerant of other people.
And so would you say that really so much starts with our own relationship with ourselves that we then extend to others? Or is that not the order things go always?
Yes and no, because, you know, as John Bowlby said, what cannot be told to the mother or the other cannot be told to the self. So no, you can't do it all by yourself. These things are interactional processes. And as long as you hide from yourself, you hide yourself from other people, you suppress part of yourself, of course. So yes, at the core, we are in charge of ourselves. We better get to know ourselves, but we can't do it alone. Depend on each other.
So as we start to wrap up, I want to come back to this idea of becoming masters of our own ship. What is your big picture and advice for people wanting to do that?
Well, I think the way you do that is to really know that you are a body that has certain properties and certain requirements that need to be taken care of, and that at the core, there's only one person who can take care of you, and that's you. That means that you need to really be very aware it is that what this creature needs in order to be functioning, to be a life human, and to so many people know that. Oh, I'm too busy for that, or I don't have the time for that. And then, you'll certainly have time to die. You certainly have time to get sick. You certainly have time to pay your taxes on April 15th. But an issue of really of how can I best take care of this creature, and also to become aware of, I think a very important part of meaning your life is, and what can I do for you? How can I make you happy? How can I make this better community? What can I contribute to people around me?
So what's next for you with research and exciting in the field of trauma?
For me, I'm a skeptic, and I also grew up in a religious family. And so I've always felt like, is this really true? And so it's really trying to find out. When people say something, I always go like, that may be true for you, but it may not be true for me. And so let's see if that is also true. For me, the most exciting thing clearly is about religious psychedelics in the last 10 years and how profoundly psychedelics can change minds. It is Pandora's box. It actually can be very damaging to people. And the politics around psychedelics is horrendous once again. What they see is the for-profit industry is rushing in to see how much money they can make for psychedelics, rather than how can we give people optimal experiences. So as often happens, it has become one big mess, but I also have seen more profound changes in psychedelics than I've seen in anything else that I've done in my long career, but not exclusively. I've also seen great effects of psychodrama and theater and yoga, mindfulness practices, and all kinds of different things. Depends a little bit of where are you, what culture you live in, people about you, who you can share with.
And I think that that's one of the major advances that has happened in the last several decades around trauma is being able to recognize that we need lots of different modalities.
Yep.
We can't just rely on one. We need lots of different entry points, even for people based on their culture, based on their experiences, based on what they're going to be resistant to and open to. And having more tools has been a really helpful thing.
The hardest thing is not for me to write a book about trauma. The hardest thing is for a consumer to find the right people to work with. You know, and that I find in every part of my life, even being as well connected as I am, I still often cannot connect people up with a person. So I think the bottom line is everybody needs to find their own people who they can work with. And that can be very challenging sometimes. But it's also problematic is that when you're a traumatized person, you don't trust yourself very well. I think I'm a very defective person. So if you go to see somebody and treatment is not helpful, a very common response is like, there must be something wrong with me that this isn't working for me. And how do you make a really good judgment? No, this is not the best thing for me. See, where else can I go to find somebody who can help? And I think that exploration is a tough exploration.
Yeah, why we're still in the situation that we are, where we have so much knowledge. Yes, we still need more. And yet, even with the knowledge that we've gained, people still get lost. Last words of wisdom that you would share then, given that context of it can be hard to find resources and get connected with people who can develop trust with.
One of the better things I wrote in the book was chapter 13, How to Find a Therapist. And that's where you go see somebody to see what it feels like to be with them. What does it do to your gut? Of course, when you're traumatized, you can always judge your gut. And your gut may be set for danger. And you may still pick up that somebody's dangerous when in fact they aren't, which is complex. But at the end, when you talk to a therapist, you ask them, so have you had this experience yourself? Have you had the treatment that you're going to give to me? And has it benefited you? And you don't want the details of trauma story or work with, but people need to be say, yes, I've done it and it helped. And that was very much the core of my book. I can honestly say I write about 7 different treatments. I have gone through all these treatments. I know how to do them. I know them well. And I can say that is what that treatment did for me. And I would not inflict the treatment on you that I don't at least have some sense of how helpful it has been to other human beings also. It's a huge topic, you know, it's life. It's everything.
Which I think is why it's time that everyone understand trauma, whether they think they've had trauma or not. We could argue that one, but it's no longer something that can just be pushed into the corner. This is a life conversation, and everyone now needs to understand trauma, the mind and the body. And thank you for tuning into this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I want to circle back to this principle from the conversation. Healing is not about perfection, but about reconnection. It's about learning to be curious about ourselves, to prioritize our body's needs, and to understand that we are the ones that we've been waiting for. If you would like to know more about the healing journey, I have resources for you in the show notes. I will put a link to my guide on steps to identify and heal trauma, a roadmap for healing. This is where we start because I lay out the essential sequence, but more importantly, there's so many that I talk to who don't know that their body is holding trauma, and this is how you could start to help know. There's also my Biology of Trauma book, How the Body Experiences and Holds Fear, Pain, and Overwhelm, and How to Heal. And at the time of this recording, the Insider's Circle Book Club is now open and pre-orders are going live soon. Publication date is September 23. If you're ready to just get started, then you might want to join me for the guided journey through that essential sequence. This is a 6-week journey into your nervous system, your body, your inner world, where I teach you the most practical and effective somatic and parts self-practices that lay your foundation to do the deeper work safely. These are the daily practices that I have found that change one's biology and health symptoms the fastest when the body is holding trauma. There's also a couple related podcast episodes that you'll want to check out if this was interesting to you. Episode number 90, The Biology of Behavior with Dr. Rob Lustig. And then episode 92, How the Chaos of Early Childhood Trauma Still Affects Our Adult Nervous System Today with Dr. Tian Dayton. A few related YouTube videos, Why Feeling Safe is Essential for Healing the Body. And I will also include the YouTube video for that interview with Dr. Robert Lustig. I'm here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the healing journey. So please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review. Your reviews and feedback are how I know to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help others find information that could change their life as well. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.